Welcome to Hematologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Jeff Sharman, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice with follicular lymphoma.
So this was a 57-year-old woman who I saw in my clinic. And in the Northwest, we have a lot of patients who have very strong feelings about chemotherapy, and this patient really highlighted those issues. She was a 57-year-old yoga instructor, motivational speaker, and very charismatic, dynamic woman who probably had been sick for a while, had had adenopathy for a while, and had delayed presentation, I think because she just didn't really want to admit that she was sick, but had cervical adenopathy, inguinal adenopathy, ended up getting a CT scan that showed massive splenomegaly into her pelvis, hepatomegaly, and really extensive adenopathy throughout cervical axillary mediastinal regions. She had an excisional node biopsy, which showed very typical follicular lymphoma. It was grade 3A. A pathologist didn't see any diffuse component for stage 3B, but was concerned, felt like there was a high rate of proliferation. And PET scan showed widespread disease with an SUV of 12 to 16, which is kind of high for follicular lymphoma. She had elevated LDH and really was an extensive or high tumor burden patient. And for those patients with high tumor burden follicular lymphoma, and this was back in 2011, I think that the decision point is between R-CHOP or R-bendamustine. And because of her sort of high proliferative rate, this question about possible occult transformation, really, even though none of the PET scans showed any spot really highly suggestive of transformation, but I kind of felt a little more comfortable with anthracycline-based chemotherapy. And as I explained what was involved to this patient, she just essentially said, there's no way you're going to do that to me. I'm not going to lose my hair. I would rather die of my disease than go through what you're talking about. So we suggested R-CHOP chemotherapy for her. We were concerned about the possibility of either occult or early transformation. And really, she had high tumor burden. And, you know, this was 2011. Some of the R-bendamustine data was relatively new at the time. But she really made clear there's just simply no way that we were going to treat her with R-CHOP. She wasn't going to tolerate the alopecia. She was not going to accept the risk of cardiac toxicity. So here I have this woman with really strong indications for treatment, bulky disease, symptomatic, needing therapy, but not really willing to take what I was suggesting as the most appropriate therapy.
So what were you thinking at that point?
So at that point, I was considering rituximab monotherapy, which quite honestly didn't seem like enough for her. That to me is a therapy in the sort of GELF low tumor burden type patient. But this patient, who I should mention, even had circulating follicular lymphoma. It just didn't seem like enough. And there was some preliminary data at that point in the relapse setting with the combination of lenalidomide rituximab. And sort of almost to my regret at the time, I made mention of sort of a non-chemo immunotherapy-based approach, and she really jumped on that. And so, again, this was 2011. We didn't have a ton of data for this, but she eagerly jumped on this opportunity.
So is that what you gave her, R-squared?
Yeah, so she received R-squared. She got lenalidomide, 25 milligrams, days 1 through 21 of a 28-day cycle. I gave her weekly rituximab times 4 with rituximab then every other month for 4 additional dosages. So a total of 8 dosages of rituximab. And she did develop some cytopenias, had a little bit of fatigue, but the disease simply melted away. It was really a quite stunning response. In this case, her adenopathy really resolved within the first 8 weeks of therapy. And when we repeated the PET scan, she'd actually had a PET negative CR. And we even redid her marrow, and she had cleared her marrow as well. So she had a very profound response. And I think that that's what we've seen now in published literature from the MD Anderson group in the frontline setting, as well as some of the relapsed refractory publications.
And I see here she continues in CR 4 years later. What's your take on why this regimen seems so active?
I think that the T cell function in patients with B cell malignancies is suboptimal. We have really nice data out of England in the CLL setting of the CLL cells inducing sort of T-cell energy or T-cell apathy, if you will. And so I think that you can have adequate numbers of T-cells, but functionally they're significantly compromised. And I think that what's happening, you see in some of these CLL publications, that you really alter the gene expression of the T-cells. And so rituximab, working in part through ADCC, antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity, I think if you have a poorly functional T-cell compartment, you may not get the full effect. And so in my own mind, I've thought of it as going on a road trip and having a roadmap and a pot of coffee. And the roadmap is the rituximab and the pot of coffee is the lenalidomide. And the two really are highly synergistic. When you look at the MD Anderson data, it looks every bit as good as some of the frontline cytotoxic therapies and potentially even superior. And there is currently an ongoing frontline trial comparing lenalidomide rituximab to investigators' choice of R-CHOP, R-CVP, and R-bendamustine. That study's completed accrual, and if, in fact, it reads out as either non-inferior or possibly even superior, I think we may see a significant paradigm change in the management of frontline follicular lymphoma. And I should say that that study is not restricted to low tumor burden patients. In fact, it's true across all tumor burden. And in the MD Anderson experience, the sort of amount of follicular lymphoma a patient had going into therapy really had very minimal impact on the outcome. Patients with high tumor burden did quite well.
So now we have another agent approved in FL, adalimumab. Where does that fit in your practice?
The labeled indication for idelalisib is following two prior lines of therapy. I think it's important to note that the data for ibrutinib in this population is, at this point, fairly weak. In those patients who are considered rituximab refractory, the single agent response rate to ibrutinib is 6%. And unfortunately, I think that there is, in the community setting, sort of ambiguity about the specifics of labeled indications. I think that some people think ibrutinib for all, anything B-cell that moves. But I think that, unfortunately, the data doesn't support that at this point. And in the patients with relapsed follicular lymphoma, I would utilize idelalisib prior to utilization of ibrutinib.
When you use idelalisib, usually alone or with rituximab?
Well, this is also where labels matter. The route by which these drugs got approved were different. So in the indolent lymphoma study, relapsed indolent lymphoma, these patients had to be double refractory. So they had to be refractory to both rituximab and an alkylating agent. That was the inclusion criteria for the study. And those patients received idelalisib monotherapy at a dose of 150 milligrams twice daily. And in the CLL study that led to the labeled indication, these patients were not rituximab refractory. And in fact, the control arm was rituximab monotherapy. So in the CLL patients, I use it in combination with rituximab. And in the indolent lymphoma patients, it's given as monotherapy.
And we'll talk about it in CLL in a minute. But in terms of your experience with this agent in indolent lymphoma, what have you seen in terms of activity and tolerability?
You know, I think that unfortunately, the way that this drug got approved, it came with a large number of warnings that I think exceeded the reality of the drug. The package insert has four black box warnings, including, I think they worded it as fatal and or severe transaminase elevation, hepatotoxicity, diarrhea, colitis, pneumonitis, and so forth. The reality is in the safety data set of about 1,200 patients, there were between one and three cases of each of those that resulted in a fatal outcome, yet the label says fatal and or severe. Now, that's not to diminish that there are side effects of this drug, and the two that I think become most significant are the transaminase elevations, which tend to occur quite early. Those happen almost exclusively within the first 3 months of therapy. And so those patients started on idelalisib need to have their LFTs monitored probably every other week during that first three-month period. But if they escape that three-month period, the likelihood of a transaminase elevation goes down quite a bit, and you could probably check once monthly at that point. The other toxicity of most significant concern is sort of diarrhea and colitis. And this tends to occur later in the course of therapy. I think the median time frame is closer to 6 months. And when the diarrhea occurs, it's probably more of an inflammatory diarrhea rather than sort of, you know, typical pill-based diarrhea. And the labeled information suggests treatment with corticosteroids in that setting, cessation of the drug. And this can be a significant diarrhea. This is diarrhea that leads to hospitalizations and so forth. So as long as you know how to use the drug and what to look for and when to look for it, I found it to be quite easy to use. And the other part of your question was efficacy. In the registration study, the median time to response was 1.9 months. So these are very fast responses. Patients notice difference in their lymph nodes really within a few days of starting the medication.
And when you encounter either the transaminitis you talked about or the colitis, do you restart the drug once they recover?
Yeah, so some of that depends upon what our other options are and how bad it was and how well the patient's doing at that point. in the experience with idelalisib, approximately two-thirds of patients who have experienced transaminase elevations have been able to successfully rechallenge the drug, most typically with a dose reduction down to 100 milligrams BID, although some patients have resumed the 150 milligrams BID dosing. And once that transaminase has passed, it rarely occurs a second time.
And I want to go on in a second, talk about your patient who actually got idelalisib, but for CLL. But another question, do you see the lymphocytosis with idelalisib that have been seen with some of these small B-cell molecules? And if so, is it just with CLL? Do you also see it, for example, with FL?
Yeah, you know, that's a fascinating question and one that I'm glad you asked. As a fellow, this field of B-cell receptor signaling inhibition was something that I got to lead the charge on at Stanford. It was an idea I had back in 2004. And we actually started using a drug called fostamatinib. I know you've talked about it on your program before.
Is that the SYK inhibitor?
Yes, it's a SYK inhibitor, kind of not going anywhere right now. But anyhow, we had a wonderful hematology technician at Stanford, and I was treating patients with fostamatinib, and she kept asking, what are you doing to these patients? And she kept finding all sorts of circulating lymphoma at fairly low levels, but I credit her with saying, yeah, I see follicular lymphoma in the blood. I see diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in the blood. It happens to a much lesser degree than CLL. It could be buried under the noise of a routine CBC, but you can occasionally see a very mild lymphocytosis or mobilization of indolent lymphoma into the blood. And, you know, at that point, we didn't know what was going to be clinically significant or not. It raised some concern for us when we were seeing it. But I think with most of the TKIs, it hasn't proven to be clinically detrimental.
Let's get back to your cases, and why don't we talk about your 55-year-old janitor with CLL?
Oh, man, this was an incredible case, yeah. So this is a 55-year-old janitor who came into my clinic in just awful, awful, awful shape. Bulky adenopathy throughout the neck, axilla, mediastinum, retroperitoneum, inguinal regions, huge spleen. But even worse than that, he had a white count of about 180,000, platelets of about 20,000, and hemoglobin, I believe, was 8. So he had bad stage 4 disease, clearly needed immediate treatment. The problem was when we did additional molecular testing, he was IGHV unmutated and had 100% 17P deletion. So this is a patient who is not going to do well with anything. And I believe this was back in 2008. And the timing's important because how I would manage that patient now is totally different than how I managed him then. But I think it highlights the remarkable activity of some of the novel agents. So this gentleman got 2 cycles of FCR, and his white count did not go down at all with 2 cycles of FCR. It simply made his anemia and platelet situation worse, and so he was getting transfused platelets, you know, once or twice a week, red cells quite frequently. And so he got 2 cycles of FCR, and it was fairly remarkable that it did absolutely nothing for him. His white count didn't change. His red cells and platelets only got worse. We were transfusing him platelets once or twice a week, red cells. It was really an awful situation. So being sort of primary refractory rather than pushing forward, we switched to alemtuzumab-based therapy. And that actually helped quite a bit. We were able to get rid of his white count, clear out his marrow, and restore some spontaneous hematopoiesis, so we at least got him free from transfusions. But what this gentleman needed was an allogeneic stem cell transplant, and he didn't meet criteria at that point because he still had fairly bulky adenopathy. Alemtuzumab rarely impacts nodal disease. It does a good job clearing out marrow. And so we quickly cycled him through our ESHAP, bendamustine rituximab, ofatumumab, lenalidomide rituximab. And all of these sort of had either stable disease or disease progression. Really nothing was helping him at all. And at that point, we had the phase 1 study of combination therapy with idelalisib, what was called the 107 study. And though he had become CD20 negative at this point and had been refractory to ofatumumab, he enrolled on an idelalisib ofatumumab study. I really don't think that the ofatumumab did a whole lot for him. But he managed to then, he had, prior to going on study, gotten back to being transfusion dependent and, you know, was coming in with platelet counts of 0 and 1 and nosebleeds before we started. And going on idelalisib ofatumumab was life-changing for him. His nodes rapidly melted. His white count did the typical lymphocytosis. He restored hematopoiesis once again. And he really got to a place where he was eligible for allogeneic stem cell transplant. And he had been through so much therapy and his life circumstances, he elected not to do that after consultation. And after about 3 years on idelalisib, he unfortunately passed away. But it was clear that that was the drug that had more impact for him than anything else he had ever been on.
So he didn't have the opportunity to get ibrutinib?
No, he didn't. This was prior to the approval of ibrutinib.
So you said that you would have treated him differently today. I'm assuming that means he would have gotten ibrutinib. But what do we know right now about both ibrutinib as well as adalimumab with, you know, adverse cytogenetics, specifically 17P?
Yeah, so this really gets to what is my treatment algorithm in the frontline setting. And so for patients with CLL, it's almost impossible to overstate the importance of molecular testing. Unfortunately, we have data to show that only about half of patients will get FISH panels done prior to therapy. And I think that that is a sad reality that needs to change, and hopefully people can understand that. So for those patients who have high-risk disease, and I would define high-risk disease as the presence of 17p deletion, but in Europe, it's customary to test for TP53 mutations as well. And unfortunately, that's simply rarely done in the United States outside of academic medical centers. It's something that I do routinely. I like to test for TP53 mutations. And in fact, there's even a third population called BIRC3, B-I-R-C-3. These patients do every bit as poorly as patients with 17p deletions. So in these patients, I think that the appropriate therapy is tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And in the United States, there's only one agent with a labeled indication in this setting, and that's ibrutinib. And it has a really remarkable efficacy in the frontline management of 17p deleted patients. There's not a huge number of patients who have been reported in the frontline setting, but my own experience in this setting has been very, very positive. In Europe, however, there is labeled indications for both ibrutinib and idelalisib in combination with rituximab in those patients with 17p deletion. And in my own practice, I have a clinical trial in that setting and would place patients on clinical trial.
Any take right now indirectly comparing the two, ibrutinib and idelalisib in 17p?
I think from an efficacy perspective, that's difficult to generalize. I think some of the efficacy is likely based upon the ability to tolerate therapy. We know that idelalisib rituximab in the frontline setting does have a higher rate of transaminase elevation and colitis than it does in the relapse refractory setting. So I think that you could make a reasonable argument for either one in the frontline management of 17p deletion. However, I think that ibrutinib is probably going to be better tolerated in the long term in that setting. So I think you could use either of those factors in your decision.
If you were able to access it, would you use ibrutinib, period, up front in CLL?
No, I wouldn't. And I feel strongly about this because I think that there's some really interesting data about the management of patients with low-risk CLL. And so MD Anderson put out an abstract in 2012 at ASH asking whether or not CLL is potentially curable in some subset of patients. And FCR is not an easy regimen to give, and the typical patients in community practice aren't going to be fit enough for FCR. In fact, we see that only about 20% of frontline patients are getting FCR in the community setting. But in those patients who really the best data on this comes from the German CLL8 study, which was FC versus FCR. And in those patients with low-risk CLL, and let me define that, that is the absence of 17P, 11Q, the absence of any additional high-risk genomic mutation, including TP53, SF3B1, NOTCH1, and in general, those patients with IGHV mutated, not unmutated. So these patients have low-risk CLL, and what we see is progression-free survivals out at 7 years in the substantial majority of patients. So there's some question as to whether we're even seeing a plateau on the curve. So with some relatively brief intensive chemotherapy, those patients with low-risk CLL can oftentimes derive 10-plus years of disease control. And I think that we may miss an opportunity to do that if we simply put everybody on ibrutinib or other BTK inhibitors.
So let's move this discussion forward. And why don't you bring in your 89-year-old lady?
Sure. So this, again, gets back to fitness. And we've presented data on the differences in patients seen in academic medical centers versus those seen in community practice. And those patients in community practice are on average 10 years older. They have lower renal function, which is critical for fludarabine metabolism, and they have higher comorbidities. And so the patients we see in community practice are older and more frail. And so quite simply, if you look at the inclusion criteria for CLL-8 and CLL-10, which were the German studies that had creatinine clearance requirements of, I believe, 70 milliliters per minute, very limited comorbidities and so forth, it's a very small minority of our patients who fit those profiles. And I think it's illustrated in my 89-year-old woman. We ran a frontline study in previously untreated CLL patients with obinutuzumab. And the study we performed was 1 gram versus 2 gram dosing. That manuscript is in preparation and submission, but it's been presented in abstract form at ASCO. John Bird's first author, and I'm senior author on that. So this 89-year-old woman was referred for lymphocytosis. She had a white blood cell initially of about 20,000, and additional testing did show a deletion 11Q as well as IGHV unmutated. So she was concerning, even though she had normal hemoglobin, normal platelets at the time. But really over a 1 year period of observation, her white count rose to 100,000, hemoglobin and platelets began to fall, and she was having progressive fatigue. CT scan showed widespread non-bulky adenopathy, which oftentimes the 11Qs have more bulky adenopathy. She had moderate splenomegaly, and really in an 89-year-old, I believe her creatinine was 1.8. You're going to be limited in terms of the therapies that you have, and I felt that she fit the intent of the obinutuzumab monotherapy study that we had. And so she did go on study. Like most patients who receive obinutuzumab, the first cycle had a fairly considerable infusion reaction. My experience now, having treated probably 40 or 50 patients with obinutuzumab, is that the sort of kinetics of the infusion reaction are very different than rituximab. One's more like lightning, the other's like thunder. Obinutuzumab is sort of a quick, very early, immediate, significant infusion reaction that once it's settled down, doesn't seem to come back. Whereas rituximab, you know, every time you kind of crank up the dose, you see the infusion reaction happening more. It's more like the thunder.
Could you elaborate on exactly what happened to this lady?
Yeah, so she had received appropriate pre-medications, including corticosteroids, acetaminophen, Benadryl. And in her case, you know, as an 89-year-old woman who had comorbidities, fairly significant comorbidities, in the chair, she became hypotensive. She became, I would say, less responsive. In her case, it was a little bit hard to separate out the effect of 50 milligrams of Benadryl. But she was, you know, supine in the chair, and the nurses were giving additional Benadryl. And, you know, she recovered after about 30 minutes, which I would say is fairly typical. In this drug, we do split the dose. So the first dose is 1,000 milligrams, but we split it day one and day two with 100 milligrams and 900 milligrams, respectively. And she was able to get through the 100 milligrams, and she never had an infusion reaction again after that.
Do you ever use less than 100 milligrams in the first dose? I think that's been looked at, hasn't it?
There was a phase one in the relapsed refractory setting, and I believe actually our study was running parallel to the German CLL-11 study. And so it was during both of our studies that we changed the dosing schedule to have the 100 milligram pre-dose, if you will. But to the listeners, I would say that obinutuzumab is qualitatively a very different drug than rituximab. And I credit our nurses, who are really wonderful and figured out how to give this drug very comfortably, where the patients are generally going to have their infusion reaction within the first 25 milligrams of the drug. And it's really imperative to quickly hold the infusion. So as soon as you see it, to hold it. And it seems, in our experience, that earlier interruption of the infusion seems to offset some of the acuity of the infusion. I can't say that I have strong data to support it, but that's been our experience. Is really after 5 to 10 milligrams, the nurses even joke that sometimes they were wondering if the obinutuzumab had even cleared the infusion tubing when they were seeing it. But again, once that infusion reaction has stopped, it really doesn't seem to happen again.
Do you have any concerns? And I have heard oncologists in practice verbalize concerns about giving elderly, frail patients obinutuzumab. I mean, this lady is 89.
Yeah, you know, I can understand that apprehension because I think that the infusion reactions are significant. But I think that, you know, from the German CLL-11 study, I think the improved efficacy demonstrated over rituximab, right? So they got an additional year of progression-free survival over another established CD20 regimen. I think that this really is a considerably more effective therapy. And yes, I think if you've never given obinutuzumab, I would have apprehension with the first dose. I've actually had patients come to my institution for their first dose, and then I've sent them back to their own institution for additional dosages. Conversely, we've just done this enough times that I think if you are able to achieve early cessation of the infusion during the infusion reaction, we found it to be quite well tolerated.
And once this lady got through her treatment, what happened in terms of her disease?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that's really interesting is even after that 100 milligram dose, you'll see patients come back. If you test a CBC at the end of the infusion or on day two, they will largely have cleared their lymphocytosis within 24 hours. This particular woman looked 89 and sort of lived it out. She, after several dosages, ended up hospitalized with urosepsis. She had frequent urinary tract infections. She ended up actually in the ICU, but she cleared that. She finished out her obinutuzumab. By response criteria, she had a very good partial response. She had one single node that I think was sort of 1.7 centimeters, so it didn't require that we redid a marrow, but she had normalized her hematopoiesis, and she's really done quite well over a two-year period of following thereafter.
So can you talk a little bit about the biology of obinutuzumab, how it differs from rituximab and ofatumumab? And, you know, for example, how common or uncommon would it be to see a response like this lady to rituximab alone? And what have you seen in other patients who've gotten obinutuzumab alone?
So the biology of obinutuzumab versus rituximab, I think if I had to identify the key difference, it would be that one's what's considered a type 1 antibody and the other's considered a type 2 antibody. And the main difference there has to do with whether or not CD20 clusters in what are called lipid rafts after the engagement of CD20. And with rituximab, it does. With obinutuzumab, it doesn't. And it's thought that there might be differential signaling from CD20 in response to localization into these lipid rafts. And so it's thought that obinutuzumab may result in direct cell killing. Simply by binding of CD20, you get cell death, even without complement or ADCC or some of the other mechanisms of rituximab. There are other differences. It's got a more flexible hinge region. It's been afucosylated, so it's gotten rid of some of the sugar residues that it's supposed to enhance ADCC and so forth. But I think that the key clinical difference is it has been demonstrated to be superior to rituximab in CLL. And no other CD20 antibody can make that claim. Ofatumumab was approved in CLL in a study that was chlorambucil plus or minus ofatumumab, whereas obinutuzumab was approved in a clinical trial that included a comparison arm against rituximab. So clinically, we know that there's superiority where we don't know that with ofatumumab. When you look at ofatumumab in the relapse setting, it performs very similarly to rituximab in the ibrutinib and idelalisib pivotal studies. So I don't know if ofatumumab is an improvement or not, but clinically we have proof that obinutuzumab is. My experience has been very favorable with the molecule. I've seen a number of patients achieve CRs, and I think that the published experience of rituximab monotherapy has largely been in the relapsed refractory setting. So it's a little bit hard to know how rituximab monotherapy would perform up front outside of the CLL11 study in which it was combined with chlorambucil. But qualitatively, I do think that these are different medications, and I think that obinutuzumab is a better drug.
So you mentioned the German study that led to the approval. Can you talk about some of the key findings, and particularly the issue of MRD and what MRD means nowadays in terms of CLL?
Yeah, great question. So MRD was sort of the endpoint of efficacy in quite a few upfront studies, sort of how much MRD can you get, minimal residual disease negativity. And so generally this is looking at a cell volume, if you will, of 10 to the negative fourth. So a very small amount of residual CLL. It can be measured in either the blood or the marrow. MRD in the marrow is harder to achieve than it is MRD in the blood. It tends to be a flow cytometry-based test, although there are other ways you can test it by DNA-based techniques and so forth, but the most commonly utilized is flow cytometry. And I think it makes reasonable sense that the deeper the response, the longer the response. And so if you can achieve MRD negativity, it's likelier to last longer. And that seems to be true of anything except the new novel agents. The new novel agents are upsetting that paradigm, and achieving MRD, it's not clear if that's going to be relevant with the novel agents. In the German CLL-11 study, it looked at MRD negativity, which essentially was not achieved with chlorambucil, was achieved to a very small degree with chlorambucil rituximab, I believe, and I haven't looked at this recently, but it was sort of in the range of 2 to 3%. And then the obinutuzumab chlorambucil, it was closer to 20 to 25%. And MRD is an interesting thing because I think we're accustomed in both solid tumor and hematopoietic neoplasms. When we look at CAT scans, we may see some residual node that's 1.7 centimeters in one dimension and, you know, smaller in another dimension. And you don't know if that represents sort of collapsed node or what it is. But you can have sort of a PR by radiographic measurements and an MRD negativity in the same patient. So you can be MRD negative even if you have a PR, and it's probable that the MRD testing is more accurate and predictive for how a patient's going to do.
What were some of the key variables in the German study that got you to use obinutuzumab?
You know, I think that the demonstration of improved efficacy in a population where you may consider them inappropriate for cytotoxic chemotherapy. And then as we started working with it in our own clinical trial and gained familiarity with the infusion reactions and how to use it, we became quite comfortable using obinutuzumab in our own institution.
Now, can you talk about the kinds of situations where you would use obinutuzumab? I'm assuming you're using it with chlorambucil, and how you decide between that and, say, BR?
Yeah, so I actually don't give obinutuzumab in combination with chlorambucil. I recognize that that is an off-label use of the medication. I think that chlorambucil adds relatively little to the overall efficacy of the drugs. It might add some, but it's not always the most convenient drug. You would think that it's been around forever, but I've actually had some access issues to chlorambucil at times. It has gone into sort of restricted manufacturing, and I had one patient where it was actually cheaper out of pocket for her to get ibrutinib than it was for her to get chlorambucil, which I found shocking. So I give it as monotherapy, and when I'm choosing between bendamustine rituximab versus obinutuzumab, really it boils down to two issues. The first issue is comorbidities and so forth. I know that I can salvage patients quite well in the relapse setting at this point, and so I don't think that there's a high need to maximize efficacy in the frontline setting at the expense of toxicity. So in an elderly patient, 70 and up, I at least start thinking about it. I feel comfortable giving bendamustine rituximab in quite a few 70-year-olds and even some 80-year-olds, but it really gets down to comorbidities and what a patient's going to tolerate.
What about duration of treatment?
So yes, the duration of therapy, the labeled dose and schedule is sort of day 1, 8, 15 of cycle 1, and then to finish out 6 months of therapy. And that's been my practice as well.
You know, it's really interesting. I haven't heard anybody talk about using obinutuzumab by itself, but there was a data set presented at ASH that I thought was really interesting. It was from the CLL trial, the German CLL trial, and they looked at people who'd been randomized to chlorambucil alone, and then on disease progression got obinutuzumab, or they added it back in, and it looked like they had a lot of activity, which made me think, like you were saying, that maybe this is really just about the obinutuzumab.
I think that the study, unfortunately, did not contain obinutuzumab plus or minus chlorambucil to really tease out the impact of chlorambucil. But again, you know, I think it adds comparatively little to the overall efficacy. And you know, chlorambucil has quite different dosages and intensities. And some people criticized that study for giving, quote, low-dose chlorambucil, sort of the day 115 schedule, as opposed to the English sort of days 1 through 7, more intense dosing. But I don't see much role for chlorambucil in the management of patients with CLL at this point.
So I want to finish out asking you a little bit about brentuximab vedotin, and particularly the work you've done looking at it in B-cell cancers, including diffuse large B-cell, where responses have been reported in patients who apparently don't have CD30 expression. I've heard a number of explanations for that, particularly related to the assay. What's your take on it?
You know, I think that there is no clear answer, and so in the absence of answer, there's hypothesis, right? And I think the most easy hypothesis is that the test doesn't capture adequately, with a static test, the dynamics of CD30 movement. We know that CD30 shuttles between the plasma membrane and I believe the endoplasmic reticulum. So it kind of goes back and forth. And, you know, possibly we're not capturing membrane CD30 very well. You know, we can wave our hands, but the surprising finding is that it does, in fact, work even when we wouldn't necessarily expect it to.
What's your approach to CD30 testing and considering brentuximab both in B-cell as well as T-cell cancers?
So the T-cell is a little more easy because there's, of course, a labeled indication, particularly in anaplastic large cell lymphoma. So to me, it's a preferred agent in the relapse refractory setting of relapsed T-cell, particularly anaplastic large cell.
What about peripheral T-cell not otherwise specified? Do you test those people?
We have seen activity in that setting. We've published that experience in Blood. And, you know, those patients are so few and far between in the community practice setting that I can't say that I have a really robust algorithm in that group of patients. But I would definitely use it. And, you know, if the other options are sort of pralatrexate or romidepsin, in a patient who's CD30 positive, if I could get access to it, I would comfortably use it off protocol. Although in that setting, I would probably do so only in the setting of CD30 positivity. And we know that in PTCL NOS, that number's not huge. It's maybe about a third of patients are CD30 positive.
And what about B-cell cancers?
So B-cell cancers, you know, probably because I have as many clinical trials as I do, I don't end up using it so much in the relapse refractory setting, although we did. We actually did that trial, and I believe that manuscript is submitted, but maybe not yet published, but has been presented in abstract form. And yes, it's an active drug in relapse large cell lymphoma. I think it's hard to know when or where to use that because we don't know how much CD30 matters or not. I mean, from the clinical trial data, we would say it might not matter all that much. So, you know, if I was looking for agents and I could get access to it, I might be willing to use it in a patient where I was looking for options.